Thank you, ladies, singers, and pianists. Morning, everyone, and Merry Christmas Sunday to you. Last week's message, in a nutshell, was this: the virgin will be with child, give birth to a son, we'll call his name Emmanuel. There was one virgin birth only, ever. There were two sons, likely, two sons born in fulfillment of that prophecy. One in Isaiah's day, born of a young woman, the normal course of events. One born in Jesus' day, Jesus himself, born of a literal virgin, to give us 10,000 joys, as we were just reminded. I know that last week was a lot of heavy lifting. I have no intent of doing that to you again this week. Part of why I went into that much detail was I fully expect at some point, 6 months, 2 years down the road, I'm going to give you another message on another double fulfillment passage in the Bible. And at that time, I'm going to say, now, you remember when we did Isaiah 7 way back when? This works the exact same way. And you're all going to go, oh, yeah, I get it. It clicks, right? So that's part of why we went into that much detail. But for today, what we need to know is two layers of fulfillment. Right, that initial, original historical context, and then in a truer, deeper way, as best we can understand, a truer, deeper way, centuries later, with Jesus Christ. The reason, or one of the reasons that led exegetes, translators, to realize there was something more going on than just that original context, what led them to that conclusion was what they went on to find later on, a few chapters later in Isaiah chapter 9. And that's exactly what we're going to find today. So we're going to look at Isaiah 9 today, one who is light in the darkness, one beyond mere human deliverance. And as we look at him and think of him, we're going to hear about the darkness of his judgment, the light of his salvation, and then very briefly at the end, a few thoughts on the peace of his presence. The darkness of his judgment, the light of his salvation, the peace of his presence. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Isaiah goes on to write, "But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the latter time he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at harvest, as they are glad when men divide the spoils of war. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as but fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." This is the word of the Lord. First, I know, Christmas is supposed to be about light. So why are we talking about darkness, especially first? Why talking about darkness if Christmas is supposed to be all about light? Well, the first reason is light is sweeter if you have known the darkness. You appreciate it more if it arrives to you while you are in the midst of darkness. Why do we celebrate Christmas when we do? Why do we celebrate it now, December 25th? You know, we don't know exactly when Jesus was born, which day. I hope that's not a surprise. We don't know exactly which day he was born, but if I were a betting man, and I'm not, don't worry, but if I were a betting man, I would not place money on December 25th. On the one hand, it's about a 1 in 365 chance you'd be right. Those are not very good odds. But also, there may, in fact, be some very subtle clues that he was born in a different season of the year altogether. Very subtle. That's beside the point for today. Just saying, it's not very good odds. It's December 25th. So why do we celebrate it now? Why do we celebrate it when we do? Why did the early Christians choose to put the commemoration of Christmas when they did? And the answer is, the early Christians knew that the darkest time of the year was the best time, the best symbolism, the time at which the message of Christmas itself would have the most meaning. It's in the midst of the darkness that the light has come, the light has shone. Isaiah 9, the message is most meaningful when it's dark. Isaiah 9 does the very same thing. Verse 2, it's the people walking in darkness who have seen the great light. Verse 2, and in fact, it's not just that one phrase. There are loads of clues that the passage I read us, chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, that it's meant to be read as a unit the whole way through with 7, 8, and 9. Clues that they're meant to be read together. And if you read the portions just before and just after this sort of Christmas passage, verses 1 through 7, if you read just before and just after, they are loaded with images of darkness, judgment, punishment. Christmas only ever makes sense in the context of darkness. So it's celebrated the darkest time of year, and let's surround the message of it with images of divine judgment, Isaiah 8 and Isaiah 9. Makes the most sense in the context of darkness. Now, let me show you just a little bit of what that judgment is about, how it works, what it's like. I didn't read you all of 8 or the rest of 9, but let me just give you a few little snippets from the parts I didn't read. There's so much here that I have to pick and choose. There's no other way around it. It's just a few little snippets. In verse 8 of chapter 9, the very next verse after where I stopped the reading, in verse 8 we find that the Lord has a word against Israel, a word against his people. Now this is the very same time frame as what we heard last week. King Ahaz down in Judah, weakened national leadership, increasing international threat, Assyria. You have these two other kings, Pekah and Rezin. The nations of Israel and Syria, they are joining together. They are pressuring God's people, saying, join with us in order to resist them. And Ahaz does not look to God for the solution. Ahaz does not look to God for peace or deliverance. He looks rather to Assyria. He looks somewhere else. And in response to that, God says two things. He says both that Assyria is going to be judgment for what is already going on there, already wickedness. He's going to send Assyria to judge. He also says the people will be further judged for looking to Assyria itself for protection rather than to God. All right, so they're sinning. They're deserving darkness and judgment because of that sin. And the description that Isaiah gives in these chapters of that judgment shows us several characteristics of the way divine wrath against sin works. The way sin itself is its own darkness. Shows us several characteristics. Shows us that the darkness, the judgment, is both exact and escalating, and it is thorough and theological. It's exacting and escalating. It's thorough, all comprehensive. It's thorough and theological. Here's what I mean. First, the judgment is exact. At one point, chapter 8, verse 6, at one point, God compares his protection of the people to the waters of Shiloh. Now, the image we should have in mind is those waters of Shiloh were gentle, they were restful, they were sweetly flowing, they were restorative. But God says the people scorned those waters of Shiloh. They wanted nothing to do with them. It was as if it were that they wanted more power than that. Something more interesting, more mighty. Not these gentle flowing waters. We want some real might going on. And so God says in the middle of chapter 8, fine, you want the waters? I'll give you the waters. And he says, I'm going to send you Assyria, and he likens Assyria to the great river Euphrates, the river that Assyria was, of course, always linked with. And he says, I'm going to send you Assyria, and it's going to be like this great river that overflows all its bounds, all its banks and channels. It's going to be a flood, and it's going to fill your land until it's up to your neck. You want the waters? You want mighty waters? I'll give you the waters. We see the judgment of God is not random. It's not arbitrary. In judgment, he is giving people exactly what they have asked for in sin. You know, sometimes the worst thing that can happen to you is to get exactly what you thought you wanted, only not the way that you thought you wanted it. It's no surprise Danielle is what we might say trendy, and I am what you might say I am traditional, right? We sometimes have this discussion or debate about whether it's more appropriate to say that I have a different sense of style than she does, or whether I have no sense of style at all. If you ever like the outfit I'm wearing on a Sunday morning, she gets the credit for it, including today, Christmas colors. All right, so thanks to her. She's got the sense of style in our family, and more than once something like this has happened. She'll buy me something that is currently trendy, currently fashionable, and I won't like it. It's too new. It's too modern. It's outside my comfort zone. One time she bought me this pair of plaid shorts. It's like, I'm not wearing plaid shorts. By the time it got to where I was comfortable, I kid you not, by the time I was comfortable wearing the plaid shorts, they were out of style. But then I liked them. I wasn't trying to mess with her, it's just that's what I liked. And they finally were broken in, they were comfortable, and so I started wearing them all the time, and she's embarrassed. She's like, would you stop wearing the plaid shorts? Sometimes the worst thing that can ever happen to you is to get what you thought you wanted, just not in the way that you thought you wanted it. More seriously, have you ever said, in action, if not in word, I don't have time for a quiet time with the Lord in the morning. I just want to get up and get my day started and get to work. And you find yourself years later so busy, so overworked, so stressed out, you're ready to crack. What's happening? You're getting what you asked for. You can do it at the other end of the spectrum. You get to the end of your career, you say, I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore. I just want to retire. You go into retirement, and within 2 years, 5 years, maybe sooner, you're bored out of your mind. You want something productive to do. You want some work. It's one of the worst things God can give you is what in your own sin you are asking for. It's grace that restrains our own sinful desires. But notice the divine justice, the judgment is not whimsical. I'm just going to send you something awful just because. It's him saying, you keep choosing this? Fine. Go right ahead. I will stop you no longer. It's an exacting justice. The judgment of God is justice. It fits the crime. It's what you were asking for. That's the first thing. That's the way it works. You don't want the waters of Shiloh? Oh, you want something better, more powerful? I'll give you the waters. Here comes the Euphrates. Here comes Assyria. It's exacting. Second, divine wrath against sin is escalating. Now, I didn't read you this part, but if you go on from chapter 9, verse 8, down through the end of the chapter, and actually on into chapter 10, the first four verses of chapter 10 go with this. If you read through those verses, there's this refrain that occurs four different times. Over and over, God says through Isaiah, or Isaiah pronounces, for all this negative consequences that are taking place, for all this, his anger has not turned away, his hand is stretched out still. You find it in verses 12, 17, 21, and then a fourth time in chapter 10, verse 4. Isaiah is clearly structuring his prophecy around it, and what's happening is, in each of the sections, the judgment against sin is getting progressively worse, more and more dire. This is happening. Think that'll satisfy it? His hand is still outstretched in judgment. Then this escalates. think maybe that'll take care of everything. He'll be satisfied with that. No, his hand is still outstretched. His wrath is still active. Writing on this section of Isaiah, Ed Young once said, when famine comes, scarcity, when scarcity comes, it brings with it fretting. Things are getting worse. People then work themselves into a frenzy, exciting themselves to anger, and this anger eventually will burst out in cursing. And cursing God, King, and even one another, you end up cursing the ones who should be, who could be your only sources of help. This escalating scenario, first scarcity, then worry, then working yourselves up into a frenzy, then finally bursting forth in anger at everyone around you. So the question, of course, is, have we seen anything like this in recent months? Have we seen anything like this year? Scarcity or perceived scarcity causing worry, causing people to fret until eventually, collectively, we turn ourselves into a frenzy, all the while leading to increasing anger and irritability, lashing out at those who should be closest to us. That, whenever you see those sorts of characteristics at work, that's the judgment of God against sin. He works it out through human situations. And after each progressive level, you think, well, maybe that'll be enough. Maybe that'll take care of it. But no, there's still more yet to come. His hand is still outstretched. It's exacting, it's escalating. Third, the judgment of God against sin is thorough. In chapter 8, verse 22, Isaiah describes what he calls a dimness of anguish. A dimness of anguish. Now, that doesn't mean an anguish that's relatively dim, like an anguish that's not all that bad. Rather, it is meant to describe, it is a dim or gloomy anguish, a gloom that is made of anguish, a gloom that consists of anguish. It is gloom that is both inward and outward. It's been said that this is what happens when compressed or straitened circumstances that are really narrow to get through, really hard and challenging and difficult. Compressed, the squeeze. Straitened circumstances which become so dire they end up reflecting themselves in a corresponding state of mind. Things around you are so hard, you struggle with them until eventually your own mindset starts to take on the characteristics of the trial you're facing. Now that description was written in 1965. Of the dimness of anguish, written in 1965, I could hardly think of a better summary of 2020. Dire straits leading to increasing worry, anxiety, and anger until eventually people erupt in outbursts because their own mindset has matched the external challenges they're facing. This is the thoroughness of the judgment. External challenges, but internal straits as well, both together, inside and outside. It's a very thorough reaction against sin. And last, and I believe most profoundly, the darkness is something that's very theological. The darkness is what the Assyrians would do to them, but not just what the Assyrians would do to them. See, when you read 8 and 9 together, what you realize is this darkness of sin preceded the Assyrians. It was there before the external threat got there. The darkness of sin preceded the Assyrians, and the darkness of sin would be there after the Assyrians. It was something more severe than the Assyrian threat. The first four verses of chapter 10 describe that great day of punishment through Assyria, and then repeats even after Assyria, yet for all this, his hand is stretched out still. His anger is still not turned away. Darkness within, darkness without. Both together increasing, but it's that the inhabitants of Galilee are walking in darkness before Assyria ever even gets there. Their manner, their very course of life, their very existence is one that is in the darkness. Darkness without, darkness within, ignorance, distress, misery, and sin. Far deeper than any darkness brought on by an invasion was the inward condition of the sinful heart itself. The plight of sin. Isaiah is saying that is worse than even Assyria. Now, do you believe that? Do you get that? Do you realize, do you believe for real that the goodness of God is so wonderful that simply not knowing Him because of a heart that is trapped in sin, simply not knowing Him would be a punishment that is so bad that take the worst case scenario, whatever you think the worst possible outcome is for the country you live in, imagine that happening in full and then realize simply not knowing God is worse than that. That's what Isaiah 9 and 10 is saying. Imagine your country going to the pits, the worst possible imaginable scenario. Simply not knowing God because of sin is a worse judgment, a worse darkness than even that. Do you believe that? And if you do, do you not realize that is where we already are as a nation? We're already there. It doesn't matter what, in a sense, it doesn't matter what else is coming. We've collectively already turned our back on Him. We're already in that darkness. When that is the case, it is a grace, is it not? To give external circumstances that match up with that inner spiritual, theological darkness to get people to realize where we truly are spiritually and theologically. Merry Christmas to you. That's the first lesson of Christmas. Things are dark because of our sin, because we have strayed and turned from God. And in His justice, the darkness is exactly what we have asked for in sin. You want life without me? Go ahead. This is how it works. It's thorough, it's outer circumstances and inner state of mind, and it's theological. Our deepest problem is with God, not just circumstances around us. So, if that's the case, what brings about change? If the darkness is that bad, whatever turns it away, too. The message of Christmas is most wonderful in the context of darkness. If your deepest problem is that you've turned away from God, not just externals, but your deepest problem is that in sin we always choose other than God, then what could possibly get you out of that darkness? The answer has to be, it has to be something outside of you. If in sin you're always trapped in that, to get out of that darkness, it's got to be someone outside of you. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. A son will be born. He will be called Emmanuel, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It seems these names are what we might call labels or descriptions, like the name Jedidiah for Solomon. Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord. It was used to apply to Solomon, but was not the name that he went by day to day. It seems the same way for each of these. Jesus was called Jesus, Yeshua. Yet each of these other names are descriptions befitting His character, who He was and what He did. Unfortunately, there's a good bit of debate over whether these names might be true of someone who is merely human and not actually divine. There's debate on that in what you could call liberal Christianity, though it's not Christianity at all, but something else altogether if you're going to deny the deity of the one that these verses point to. There's debate over them, but just take that first name in verse 6. He will be called Wonderful Counselor. Just take that first name. You could do things like this with each of the four. Too much for today. Maybe we'll do it next Advent. Spend some more time in each of these four names. But for a moment, just for a moment, forget Everlasting Father. Forget Mighty God. Just take Wonderful Counselor. The title there might literally be called Wonder of a Counselor. The word there is Pele. You think of soccer, if that helps you, soccer fans. The word there is Pele, and Pele in the Bible is only ever used for acts of God, for mighty works of God. It's never used for what man does, but only ever God. You can think of all your works are wonderful, Psalm 139. Wonder like incomprehensible, inscrutable. Who can challenge Him? Who can discern His ways? The end of Job. this term alone, only ever used of God, this term alone is enough to attest to Jesus' deity. He is God in the flesh. How is your darkness taken away? It has to be one outside you. There will come a day where there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. And when Matthew introduces Jesus in his gospel, said last week, he quotes 7:14, Virgin will be with child, give birth to a son, will call his name Emmanuel, quotes that when he describes the incarnation in chapter 1 and 2. Then when you get to his introduction of Jesus' public ministry, the middle of chapter 4, he quotes this verse. He quotes this section, and he says that Jesus doing his public ministry was that light turning on, being flipped on in the darkness. We all have darkness. The only question is whether yours is going away or not. But every single one of us is darkness. If anything becomes increasingly clear to me through years as a pastor, it's that every single person in this room has junk they're dealing with. Difficult situations they're facing. We all have, every single one of us, have dark situations. The only question is whether yours is going away or sticking around. What takes it away? How's it go away? He came and he took the yoke, the burden, the rod, the staff of the oppressor. He took it on himself. The yoke of an unjust, oppressive government. Chapter 9, verse 7, he took the yoke of an unjust government on himself. The Roman system, the unfair trial. He also took the yoke of just government on himself. God's just governing against sin. He took both on himself. The end of his life, what happened? You remember? Matthew 27, they took the rod. They took the staff. They applied it to him. What was he doing? He was taking the punishment due sin, the exacting punishment, what you and I deserved. He took it on himself to break it so that you wouldn't have to bear it, but you would have peace instead. He took the exact justice against sin on himself. What else? He took the thoroughness of darkness on himself. Thoroughness, we said, was inner and outer. The inner darkness, the psychological pressure of one who is perfectly sinless, bearing the full weight of every sin ever. The internal pressure, matched by physical circumstances. He was nailed. He was beaten. He went through all that pain. He was fully restricted. Inner and outer anguish totally coming together in his life at the cross. God's hand, we said, God's hand was outstretched in wrath. No matter how bad things got, there was still more wrath yet to be poured out. So what would eventually satisfy it if no human circumstances ever would? What would eventually satisfy God's hand stretched out in wrath? Only God's hand stretched out to receive wrath, to take it on in full. He took all the escalating nature, what it was all building toward, he took it on himself so you wouldn't have to deal with it. And he took the darkness, the theological separation from God. Remember, from noon to 3, which would have been the brightest part of the day, darkness settled over all the land. Exactly what in sin we've chosen, he was taking it on himself so you wouldn't have to. The darkness was a shadow of death, not just the Assyrians. The darkness was such as could be removed only by a light of life. The darkness of sin can only be dispelled by something that is its very opposite, namely light. That light is a gift of God. It cannot be produced from a human heart, which is itself in darkness. The whole work of Christ and all the blessings which he brings may be characterized by this one word, light. The light is shown. The light is both what you see, and the light is what you see everything else by. As we said last week, it was wrestling with this text that led those ancient Jewish rabbis to realize there was something far more going on, something that could only be fulfilled in one who was God in the flesh, doing what your human heart and mind could never do on our own. We all have darkness. The only question is whether yours is going away. And he is what takes it away. Now, what do you do with all that? 3. Just a few thoughts very briefly. What do you do with all that? First, well, you believe. You believe it. Christmas is that your plight in sin was so dark that nothing other than this could fix it. Nothing other than God Himself coming down in the flesh and dying in your place. That's the only thing that could solve it. Message of Christmas. But the message of Christmas is that God did that. That He was glad to do that. That He looked at your darkness, the hardship you face, and so loved you. He said, I'm not going to let you there. I'm not going to wait for you to pull yourself out of it on your own. I'm going to walk down into the middle of it with you. And so no matter what else is going on, no matter what answers you feel you don't have, look at Him and realize He's with you in the midst of it. And will be always until one day you see Him face to face and that light casts away all that darkness for good. The darkness will be fleeting. You believe. You don't harden your hearts. First thing you do is you believe. Second thing you do is you rejoice. You rejoice in God. The salvation of sinners produces exultation in the hearts of God's people. It causes you to rejoice when you know it. Such jubilation is a gift of God Himself. To rejoice in God is the highest form of rejoicing. Indeed, it can be safely said, it is the only form of rejoicing, true rejoicing. Man's chief end is not only to glorify God, but also to enjoy Him forever. And it only comes about only by means of a God-induced response to His own mighty work of salvation. Only by that do men truly joy before Him as they should. It's a marvelous joy. The picture there in Isaiah 9 is when men, when farmers, when harvesters would gather in the grain, they'd say, look how much there is. All of this toil was not for nothing. There's an abundance. And they begin to divvy it up. They count it up. That's the picture. The picture of men dividing the spoils, the plunder of war. There's victory. There's more than we ever thought there would be. That's the picture. You see, when you get a load of what God has done in Christ, you believe, you rejoice, and third, last, when you see this, you have peace while you wait for that day when you experience it in full. You know His peace. Of the increase of His government and peace, there will be no end. This is the only time where that sentence is a good thing. Government will be ever expanding, and you'll like it. It's been said, nothing is so permanent as a temporary government expansion. Nothing is so permanent as a temporary government expansion, all right? Bad news in every other government except for this one. Was the ever-increasing expanse of His government, it's a good thing. This is the only government that perpetuates itself through peace, not through war. When you know it, you will be evidenced by a peacefulness no matter what goes on. And in some mysterious way, your peacefulness, your presence, will be part of that, the multiplying and the expanding of that kingdom to others who themselves are in darkness as they see the light that He has placed inside you, the light He's making you to be. That's what it means to see through the eyes of faith the light. You see Him. You see everything else by Him. That's what it means to see His light in the darkness and for you to be made light in the darkness. I pray He does it for each of us this Christmas. Let's pray together. Mighty God, one who is a Father perpetually to those who are His, I pray, would You keep us from ever ceasing to marvel that Your kingdom is one of peace established by justice and righteousness. Keep us from ceasing to marvel that You have worked Your justice and righteousness in such a way as to bring peace for all those who will repent, believe in you, place our faith in you. I pray you lead us to kneel in awe at what you have done and who you who are wonder itself. Mighty God, wonderful counselor, be our Prince of Peace for each one here this Christmas. We pray this in your name, in Jesus' mighty name. Amen. Our closing song is one of anticipation. Just as the people waited for the Messiah all those centuries ago, we still wait for his return. And that day when we will experience his kingdom in full and face to face. And so as the true church always has, let's long for his coming again. Let's long for it as we sing. Our closing song is, O come, Emmanuel. Let's stand and worship him together. Love to see you this Thursday for our Christmas Eve services. One of our board members said recently, I'm looking forward to that candlelit service more this year than ever before. That's what we need. We need light in the dark. We need to be lights for those in the darkness. The heading in one translation, the ESV, for the section right after this part of Isaiah 9, the section is called Arrogance and Oppression. Let's not be arrogant, or do oppression, obviously. Let's not be arrogant, but let's worship humbly, especially as we celebrate Christmas this week. Merry Christmas to you all. Thank you.